This is Josh Larson from Film Spotting and Think Christian, and you're listening to The Substance.
You've landed on The Substance, a podcast aimed at being biblical, thoughtful, and human. Join us every other week as we engage the culture without the culture war. I'm Dave Hallahan, better known as, or more often referred to as, Editor Dave, and I'm glad that you're here. Philip and his family were able to go away on vacation this week, so you'll hear him in a minute. He did record the interview with our guest for this week, but I'm doing the intro and outro. And so I do just want to again say I'm glad that you're here, excited for this episode. And there's a couple other things I want to make sure you're aware of. We recently launched a Patreon page. If you head over to patreon.com/thesubstancepod, you'll see that we have a few different tiers there that you can sign up for: $3, $6, $10, or $20 a month. Right now, all of those tiers offer the same perks. And it is a great way to support the show. If you're a regular listener of The Substance and this has added some value, then a way to add value back or give value back is to head over to patreon.com/thesubstancepod. And if you are new or newer, then we would love for you to check out some of the more recent episodes, including our interview 2 weeks ago with hip-hop and spoken word artist Propaganda. Absolutely loved being a part of that conversation. A month ago now, Philip was able to talk with Mitchell from Letterboxd, talking about the movie Affliction. And before that was Caitlin Schess with The Ballot and the Bible. All just great conversations. So go back and listen to those. And with that interview we did with Propaganda, we were able to get a promo code for his Terraform Cold Brew. So you coffee drinkers out there can head over to terraformcoldbrew.com. And when you place your order, use promo code SUBPOD, S-U-B-P-O-D, for 20% off your order. And that is good through the month of September. Here at The Substance, we invite thoughtful, interesting folks on, and we talk for about an hour or so about things related to faith, culture, and the arts. Previous guests include people like Alyssa Wilkinson, Tyler Huckabee, Mike White from the Projection Booth podcast, and our friends Slim and Mitchell over at Letterboxd. And this week, we're excited to welcome Josh Larson back to the podcast. Josh has been on before, but if you're not familiar with him, he's a Chicago film critic, host of the longtime running Film Spotting podcast and the Think Christian podcast, author of Movies Are Prayers, and his new book, which is the topic of conversation for this episode, Fear Not, A Christian Appreciation of Horror. Philip and Josh cover a lot of ground in their conversation. Can people of faith be edified by horror stories? What unique truths are specific horror subgenres positioned to help us think about? They cover slashers, sex and death tales, monster movies, prophetic horror, and more. I'm sure that you will enjoy this conversation. So here it is, Philip and his conversation with Josh Larson.
Josh Larson, welcome back to The Substance.
It's good to be back. Last time we were talking about The Living Dead, was that about a year ago?
Or that was last year. I think we recorded in September for an October release for Halloween. So that was literally that was 11 months ago. And
okay.
I think your book was maybe even finished. And you're like, yeah, it's going to come out sometime. I think they might hold me until next fall. And here we are.
Here we are. Yeah, well, it's good to be back on the show.
Yeah, it's good to have you. I was looking at some of the promotional materials, and I think in one of – with all the social media feeds and different things going on right now, I'm not even sure where it was or where we shared it, but I loved that there was a little clip from Night of the Living Dead in your Fear Not promo. And I was like, hey, Substance Science and Fear Not. Like, we talked about it. If you want to hear Josh talk about that, we got him for an hour.
Yep. Yeah, that worked out well.
Excellent. So I want to get right to it here because I know you've got a heart out here. So Fear Not, A Christian Appreciation of Horror Films, part of the Real Spirituality Monograph series. I know you've done this before, but just for our audience here, kind of give us a brief idea of why horror, what the goal of this particular was. In addition to that, kind of give us the elevator pitch for horror and for your goals with the book.
Sure. Yeah, this was a bit of a commission project. As you said, it's part of that Real Spirituality monograph series, which Fuller Theological Seminary, Brem Film, puts out. Great series that is from a variety of different angles, just trying to bring film fans along to think theologically about the movies. And they've always wanted to do a book on horror. I similarly have always loved horror. And over at Think Christian, we write about horror a fair amount. In 2015, I think I wrote a blog post, A Christian Defense of Horror, that generated some good conversation. So once we started doing a podcast at Think Christian, we made it an annual thing. We just talk about a classic horror film and a recent one, particularly from a theological perspective. So what the folks at Real Spirituality were interested in is basically that, an introduction on one level to horror for those who are maybe have a little trepidation about it, but love movies. And then maybe not so much a defense, try to take a more even positive approach with the book of here's what's really great about horror films from an artistic aesthetic angle, why they deserve that sort of respect, but also from a theological perspective. Why should these matter to Christians? What can Christians gain from them? And yeah, I can talk maybe a little bit more about the way I went about that. It's not the only way I think Christians can engage with horror films, but it was an intriguing one to me that I thought could sustain a book and be an interesting project to dig into.
Yeah, I enjoyed your blog post back when it came out, and I've enjoyed, I think for the last 4 years, your Defense of Horror annual episodes. I know we talked last time you were on, the Barbarian and Halloween episode was coming out. I just re-listened to all four of those again in the past week or two, just preparing for this. And they're a lot of fun, and they're great to send to folks who are, like you said, on the fence, being that both of our audiences are very largely filled with people who identify in the faith, various faith communities, and horror being something that maybe at a glance or from a distance may feel incongruous in some ways with being people of faith. Maybe briefly, and I'd like to maybe get to this again at the end perhaps, but briefly, if somebody is somewhat open-minded but hesitant or maybe feels a little icky or just doesn't feel right, what might be a gentle challenge or some questions that you would have for somebody who's like, sell me on horror, I'm somewhat open?
Sure. I would say start in terms of the films, maybe with some of the more fun, older classic universal horror monster pictures. They might seem a little campy in this day and age, but I think they're still enjoyable and hit on some of these themes that will make them also interesting for Christians. And at the same time, they're not gory. They're not too intense. As I said, they're almost more historical artifacts at this time. So I think of something like, you know, the Wolfman from the 40s and the way that is very exemplary of our fear. If you think about that story, this guy who changes into a killer wolfman at night and wants to deny it, doesn't want to admit that it's him, and this is the internal struggle. It's very much about our own fears of our own capacity for sin. That's something we can resonate with as Christians. That's a very, very prominent theological idea Paul explores in his letters, our relationship to sin, our struggle with sin. And here it is up on the screen in this Wolfman story that people know about already. Everyone knows that legend, right? And so here's an approachable movie that will be fun to watch and also be a good example of the depth and richness that are in these genres. And then if you enjoyed that, then you can move maybe further into little rougher genres, little harder to watch movies if you want to. You don't have to. Not trying to make everybody a horror fan.
Absolutely.
But yeah, if you're at all intrigued, that's maybe a good place to start.
No, I agree. So I have a couple movies for some of your different chapters and topics that I want to highlight it, but I watched 9 movies in the last 2 weeks preparing for this. 8 of them were first watches. And my highest rated was a much older film that I had heard about, but had never really dove into. And it was an absolute delight. All of them that I watched, I enjoyed. But the one that I enjoyed the most that I could absolutely see over the coming years be on some of my all-time lists. And we're going to get to that here in a little bit. So I did want to hit, though, for maybe some of the people who are not as open-minded, and you deal with this right away. Talk to me about the Philippians 4:8 crew and how you engaged with that with Bonhoeffer.
Yeah, so that's a verse that, you know, I think anyone, not just horror fans, but people who engage with arts like film, TV,
anything forth. Cultural or even
anything
like
cultural. Yeah, yeah, I think that's
anything
fair.
In the culture.
Yeah, you'll be challenged on occasion by those who choose not to do that with this verse. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. And on the surface, that would seem to say, so stay away from whore. And so I do spend some time, this is in the introduction you're referring to, just looking at the context for Paul's letter to the church in Philippi and how it was more of a positive letter. This wasn't a church in crisis. This was, you know, praising this church for having these qualities and seeking these qualities, which is all good. I think we would all agree on that. But it wasn't sent to them, in other words, as because you've been doing this, put that away and you should do this, right? It's not an either or admonition that we are getting there. And the evidence of that, I think, is how much horror there is in the Bible. How many Bible stories have, you know, not only existential terror and unease and anxiety that we all feel, but very explicit things that are in horror films, demons, ghosts, murder. This is all in the Bible. And the reason for that, and you reference Bonhoeffer, you know, I came across this 1933 sermon from him, Overcoming Fear. He writes about the furious storm in Matthew 8 and Jesus' response to that and how the Bible acknowledges these things that we are afraid of. The Bible acknowledges horror. It is not telling us to only think about things that are pleasing. It's showing us that this is a reality of a life in a broken world. The Bible recognizes it and then also offers a gospel answer, a gospel response. You need to admit to the fear you have before you open up to the need you have for something like the gospel. And I think that's explored by Bonhoeffer in that sermon incredibly well. And so that was sort of an opening thing for me back when I wrote that original blog post to start thinking theologically about horror. That was just crack things open a little bit. There's something interesting here that can be applied to horror films, you know, as approachable as The Wolfman or as difficult as Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, a 1984 very gory slasher film. I think some of these ideas can be applied to both.
Absolutely. Well, actually, I'll say this as an aside here. We're going to get to slashers soon. I had one question before that, but on the Nightmare on Elm Street, I said I watched 9 movies. Technically, I guess add 6 to that. I watched 15 because I ended up doing the whole original run of Nightmare on Elm Street as well. And only
Holy
the first
cow.
One is in your list.
Yeah, you're a braver man than me.
There were three very good
ones.
There were 3 very good ones, and they're all like around or under 90 minutes. So like,
okay,
all the ones with Heather Lonnekamp would make a great triple feature.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I don't even remember if I've seen the 3 with her. I know,
yeah,
I've seen 2.
Nightmare,
of course,
Dream Warriors,
yeah,
and then New Nightmare were a fantastic trilogy.
Well, good. I'm glad you had a chance to do that.
So, silence. So, yes, I completely agree. And I've, in just my own story briefly here, I was raised very similarly, strictly, not strictly, but in a horror was definitely something that was kind of seen as outside. My parents and my immediate spiritual environment were thankfully relatively open to the arts and took me to the movies a lot. I was a library kid. Both my parents worked, so I spent a lot of time
nice.
In the library checking out videos and reading books and all that. So culture was not really kept from me, but obviously they until I was a certain age, probably like early middle school, they were really vigilant about age appropriate matters. But then kind of when the dam broke, but I didn't really get into horror until college. And then really, like, honestly, in the last 5 years or so, did I really start to appreciate it much more as a cinephile, not kind of looking down on it as John. Actually, I think the first horror movie in college that really got me into it was Night of the Living Dead. It was just
okay.
It was terrifying. It was undeniable. It was prophetic, as you talk about in your book. It really kind of opened my eyes, like, oh, like this isn't just blood and guts and bodies.
Yeah. Although there are a lot of blood and guts and bodies. So for those listening who who are thinking about where to start, maybe not quite there. It's one of the greats, though. Hopefully you'll get there.
Yeah. But just the idea of horror films in general to both evoke and to consider fear, I think that is extremely valid. And you quoted filmmaker Scott Derrickson talking about how horror is the genre of non-denial. And when I think about Philippians 4, it's the first thing it says is whatever things are true.
Yes.
That is the primacy of the text. The weight of that is on true, and those other things kind of stem from the truth. And horror and genre filmmaking and genre storytelling in general is something we've talked about a number of times on the show. I personally love how the artifice of genre, whether it's horror or Western or noir or sci-fi, what have you, it really does let you get at the truth, whether it's society or interpersonal or psychological or racial, historical, whatever, that there's something about that genre artifice that really does allow you to get at the truth in ways that are subversive and, frankly, a lot more helpful and interesting than saying, hey, let's look at these societal issues.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, that's another angle to take on that passage, which relates to the artistry that is in some of these movies. You know, those you could describe those qualities as admirable, true, you already mentioned, lovely, maybe not a lot of lovely images in horror films, but this does relate to, as people who do appreciate the arts and the artistry that is a gift God has given to all people, you know, this is another aspect of appreciating horror films is just the pure artistry and the aesthetics of it. That's another defense that needs to be made for the genre, separate from the theological defense, I think, because horror films are often dismissed, regarded as, and because they can be this, they can be cheapo, exploitative films that are made poorly. That happens. But there's also great artistry at work here in that attains some of those qualities we do see in that Philippians passage.
Absolutely. So I wanted to first dip my toe. So this is purely subjective, but when I think of horror, or let me ask you, Josh, when you think of horror, what is the first image or subgenre? Like, what do you think of first when you think of horror? And you're a longtime fan.
Great question. I probably think of those movies that I saw too young that embedded themselves deep in my subconscious. Now, I'm not advising that as a path into horror for other people. I think it got
me
started.
It's hard to avoid, though, if you're a cultured person. It's hard to avoid sometimes.
Well, and there's always, you know, you described your upbringing. Mine was very similar. Parents who love the arts but were discerning for what I should watch. And always something's going to slip through the cracks. So I write about this in the introduction, you know, a young kid at family gatherings where the parents are upstairs, right? And the kids are in the basement and a movie comes on the TV at this point. And so you watch it. So that's where I saw things for the first time, like Psycho, The Shining. And so when you say horror, I think of the Psycho shower sequence. I think of little Danny riding his bike down the halls in The Shining. I think about these sorts of films that I saw, even not very good horror films like Friday the 13th, which I saw in a different context while on a family vacation with a neighbor's family. You know, I just tagged along with the family. Different rules when you're on vacation with different families. Yep. Saw Friday the 13th way too young. That's one that comes to mind immediately. So I had not thought about that before. I love that question, but I think what flashes are the ones I saw first and probably too young.
That flashes for me when people ask you, like, what's the scariest? Like, I definitely have as somebody for the last 4 or 5 years that's been more into horror, I have my realist. But my first thing, like, for me, the two that I saw, and one's not even a horror at all, but the two that I saw, like, is either Christmas or Thanksgiving. I just went into the TV room by myself. Was a Jaws, and I remember the opening of the Harrison Ford movie Witness with the murder in the bathroom.
Wow, okay.
That was maybe the opening of Jaws and the opening of Witness were maybe the two most terrified I've ever been watching something, probably just because of my age.
Very, very different films, but yeah.
Yeah.
So with context,
very
age.
Harrowing openings.
For sure.
But for me, in general now, when I first think of horror, I think of slasher. So that was, I think, the first chapter of your book. As I was flipping through it, I kind of wanted to. So that's where I wanted to start. And I know that you, long time, or even a cursory film spotting listeners know that you're a big Nightmare on Elm Street guy. So I kind of wanted to start there for you.
My favorite horror film, one that I did not see when it came out, thankfully, because I would have been 10. So it was probably not too long after that, you know, as those sequels you mentioned started coming out, I probably saw it.
Cranked those out.
Yeah. So I probably saw it in some context, late 80s, I would think. But it's one that had an early hold on me because of that and has just shown me more richness as I've revisited it, the more I've come to learn about movies and appreciate them and study them. Wes Craven, the director, brings such a surrealism to this great concept that in our dreams, when we fall asleep and we're helpless, this killer is going to come after us. If we die in our dreams, we die in the waking world. Just such a terrifying thing that gets at the root fear of being asleep and being vulnerable. And, you know, that's why I think it stands alone as a horror film outside of any sort of theological interpretation. But when it came to placing it within the context of this book, I thought about it alongside other slashers, as you said, for that chapter, and started to recognize commonalities in some of the major slashers, like Friday the 13th, like Halloween. And it's this idea of the vulnerability, not just because we're sleeping, but because we are alone. You know, when we are asleep, even if there's someone in the bed next to us, we're really alone. That doesn't matter. And how many of these slashers, we think about the term that's fairly common now, the final girl. It's because that she's the last one left. And the victims are often on their own when these monsters or killers are coming after them. And the way I broke through with that for sort of a theological spin was thinking about Christ being alone in the Garden of Gethsemane.
And I want to let you do this. I couldn't help but now, like, being listening to Film Spotting for a long time, I don't think the book had arrived. I think the book was in the mail from the publisher. I was like, I better get started on this. I'm going to start. I think Nightmare on Elm Street was the first one, or a couple months previously, I'd watched People Under the Stairs, just because
another Craven film.
Another Craven film, but. So to actively prepare for this, I watched Nightmare on Elm Street and I was like, I wonder if Josh is going to pull the disciples thing. Like, as a person of faith, like, I feel like you almost can't not.
Especially so you went there too.
When he falls asleep twice, I was like, I don't know if there's anything there, but that's very Gethsemane-esque.
That's awesome. I love that that occurred to you. Yeah, because it makes me feel like I'm not crazy in seeing that, right? And you're referring to Glenn, Nancy's boyfriend, played by a very young Johnny Depp in A Nightmare on Elm Street. You know, Heather Langenkamp's heroine asks him to wake her up if she's struggling, and he does fall asleep. So there's that surface parallel, but I do think it echoes this notion of loneliness, which is pervasive for Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane. He feels even abandoned by God at that point. It's not just that the disciples fall asleep twice, like Glenn, but it's that he feels abandoned by God in that moment. And I'm thinking more about these slasher films and how crucial that is. You even see it in some of the landscapes, something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Oh, that yeah. Lonely, barren Texas landscape evokes this idea of being abandoned. And if we extend that to existential theological terms, it's this fear, of course, the same one Christ had, of being abandoned by God. So it seems like a surface level connection, but for me, I do really feel like these movies work on us so deeply and subconsciously that they're tapping into some of these troubling things that are also deeply theologically troubling, deeply existentially, spiritually troubling. And even something like Nightmare on Elm Street works that way.
No, and I completely agree. I think that, and to my wife's chagrin, I really have become a fan of slasher movies, but I, no disrespect at all, because I like them a lot. I'm a big Halloween fan. And now after visiting this, not quite ready to put it at the top of my list. I really enjoyed that first Nightmare on Elm Street a lot. And the Heather Langenkamp. Yeah. That first Nightmare on Elm Street, in particular, I was impressed. I was very pleasantly surprised with how genuinely scary some of the sequences were. Cause it's like, I've seen a lot of the clip shows, like being in both the film world and the last several years being a horror fan. I'm aware of some of the more elaborate deaths. I know Freddie for the one-liners and all that.
Yes.
But some of those scenes in the imagery, I think it was the first kill or the second kill, the gal who was levitating in the room by herself, Johnny Depp going in the bed, and just the visuals there. But I think for me, one of the the gets under your skin of her trying to run away on the stairs and her feet sinking into the stairs. I was just like, that's some powerful like imagery.
It really is. And I'm glad you mentioned that you first encountered it in clips, because it's not a movie that represents itself well in little snippets. You really have to succumb to the dreamlike atmosphere that is so crucial to it. Otherwise, it looks cheesy, a little hokey. The one-liners they're not my favorite part of the movie.
They're not in the first one.
There's not as many in the first one, but you could still cut Freddy to look jokier than he is in the first
movie. He's a little stinker sometimes.
Yeah. And so, it's a film if you've been
menacing, though.
Very menacing. And if it's a film you're interested in, but you've been holding off because you've only seen clips that make it look a little silly, I would say give it a shot.
And I wanted to give you guys a shout out. I might link the episode in the show notes. I'll make a note here. I knew that fake out scare was coming at the end, but it still really got me. Yeah. I recently listened to your top five jump scares and I was like, okay, I know this is coming. I just listened to Joss and Adam talk about it and it still really got me. I was like, oh, like that's just great editing and sound design.
It is. And again, playing cleverly with that real world, dream world dichotomy and not letting us always be sure of where we are between those two places.
Absolutely. The next kind of genre or topic that you touch on that I thought was a nice progression from that. Oh, I was saying earlier, slashers, I like. I think they can be very fun, very artfully done sometimes, but they are more visceral and in art-wise, you can also say they're more like lighter, or they're like the candy. There's not always a ton of meat there in slashers per se.
They're maybe they can be the most exploitative, maybe is absolutely fair to say. Yeah.
Because the new Saw movie is coming out. And that the first one, legitimately, very good movie. I enjoy some of the other ones, but that and many other highly sequelized films do kind of build on what creative ways can we dismember people?
Sure.
And that is not always the most substantive.
No, it's not.
But one of my favorite sentences in your whole book here, let me pull it up. I love a provocative statement. Your first sentence in your sex and death chapter is it possible that the Bible is more sex positive than the horror genre?
Really? That seems like going counter to what might be commonly believed, huh? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've heard you talk. I knew where you were going, but I was like, that is perfectly engineered to kind of send out there into like, that's a good tweet or that's a good like blog on a Christian site to pick up. It's like, the Bible is more sex positive than the horror genre.
Yeah. Well, what's happened to my writing? I'm writing in the form of tweets now is what I hear. But no, I this is something, it's again kind of born out of a Think Christian piece that I wrote around the film It Follows from a couple of years ago now. And that's a film that takes sexuality quite seriously as a sexual relationship as something that matters, which seems basic. But that's not where certain aspects of the culture want us to think about sex, right? It's just, we like to think about it, or we're told to think about it as just a physical act that anyone can do with anyone at any time and move along. It's very mercenary, very utilitarian. And so here, It Follows was a film that, without being preachy, while being very scary, it's in the manner of Halloween, kind of a throwback to that. The concept is that there's a curse that is being passed through sexual partners. And when one person has the curse, if they don't have sex with another person to pass it along, then this mysterious monster will follow them. They don't know what it looks like, could take any form of a person and kill them. And a lot of critics saw this as, well, it's an allegory for STDs, right? Something like that. Certainly works at that level. But to me, as someone who's very interested in how we think about sex as Christians or how we think about sex in the culture in general, it was saying something unique that's very different from slasher films like Friday the 13th or even Halloween, right? Those films say sex is bad. If you have it, especially if you're a teenager,
you will immediately die
and be punished, right? And the survivors of those films are generally the teenage girls who don't have sex.
Well, and Friday the 13th, even plot-wise, was kind of explicitly built around that concept.
It was, absolutely, yes. The original inciting incident was that a young boy died because the teenage camp counselors were having sex instead of watching him when he was on the lake. And it's all vengeance from there, right? So again, sex is death. And It Follows is suggesting that, well, as the title implies, there's something more important going on in a sexual relationship. It has an existential metaphysical weight. I thought, oh, that's interesting and really unique for a horror film. And as a matter of fact, does align more with what we see in terms of sex being discussed in the Bible, where it has a metaphysical weight. And beyond that, it's a gift to be, you know, held tenderly and within certain boundaries, but it is a gift. We see this in Genesis. We have all the Song of Songs. We see it in Proverbs described as a gift from God. And of course, going back to the Apostle Paul, someone who put a lot of rules around sex in some of his letters, but also did in some of those letters talk about it as a healthy part of a relationship, a life-giving relationship in marriage. And so I did start to think in terms of the slasher genre in general, particularly, yeah, the Bible overall has sort of a healthier approach and perspective on sex than a lot of these horror movies. And that's not, I think, how the culture at large would think about it at all.
No, not at all. One of staying in the topic, so this is what I was mentioning earlier. My favorite movie that I watched in preparation for
is
actually 1942's Cat People.
Oh, okay, great.
I was aware of it. I was aware of the the absolutely wild Paul Schrader remake, but I'd heard that the original was good. I actually just realized after I watched the film that it's in the Criterion Collection, so I'll be picking up the Blu-ray at November sale. I didn't realize. I was like, I just typed it in at my library. I saw there was a Criterion edition. I was like, oh, I'm picking that up in November on the sale. But I thought it was very interesting. So in my Letterboxd reviews, I usually will clip a line of dialogue that I felt was either funny or interesting or kind of evocative of some of the major themes. The one I wrote for Cat People that I picked up, when she is talking about the main character.
Irena.
Yes. The main character, Irena, is talking about her reluctance and fear of stepping into a real relationship. She says, but I want to be Mrs. Reed, really. I want to be everything that name means to be, and I can't. She's asking her husband to be patient, be kind. Let me have time to get over the feeling that there's something evil inside me.
Mm.
And just coming from those of us raised in conservative Christian groups, the sex was very stigmatized.
Yes.
And being a sexual being, it can be easily to make young people or adults feel that there is something evil inside them merely for the fact of them being sexual beings. And I thought,
yes,
wow, this was elevated a horror 80 years ago.
And to the point we were just discussing, that attitude runs contrary to what we see across the vastness of scripture, right? That sex in and of itself is evil. But that's exactly what it is in Cat People. It's that is what will turn her, that character, into a panther that kills. If she lets her sexuality out too much, if she gives into her urges too much, she becomes a literal killer. And so, yeah, it's an earlier film, but exactly working on the same register as some of these later 80s slashers.
And I thought that was fascinating too, particularly, I mean, so there's very explicit religious themes in a lot of these classic movies and a couple other that I want to bring up when we talk monster movies. But I thought it was fascinating in Cat People. This is a story about a woman who was raised basically in this fundamentalist religion that even when she was married, she couldn't get over. And I was like, wow, like, I can't tell you how many blogs and podcasts and stories I've heard of my peers talking about the same thing. Like, the fear of sex and sexuality getting so ingrained in people when they're young. Obviously, just like everything, good boundaries are good and healthy. Everybody needs them. But when that turns into instilling fear in people, that can easily be brought into adulthood and into marriage, where talked about Proverbs, Song of Solomon, all these things where sex is supposed to be an ecstatic, transcendent gift. But the character, even when she was married, because of her religious upbringing, she was still having that. I was like, wow, like this is we should maybe do a whole substantive cinema on this sometime.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a curse. It's a literal curse that is placed upon her. Just having those desires on their face is a curse for her.
And another shout out, I thought sometimes, with all due respect, so I love reading your reviews. I love reading your letterbox. I love listening to Film Spotting. But you're one of the reviewers who always, like, whenever I see a star rating, I throw it out the window. I'm like, what does he actually say?
good.
The pendulum with you swings so interestingly sometimes. And I remember on that same episode, I referenced the jump scares. You talked about cat people. And I was like, what? Did this guy like just watch it and he put it on because of recency bias? But when that bus stopped, I jumped out of my skin. That was a wonderful, wonderful jump scare.
It's a good one. And to be fair, you know, when I first saw Cat People, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I liked it, but I found it a little disappointing because of its reputation. And that was on me. When I revisited it for the book, and I think this is what happens when you're taking a look at a film within a particular context and you're searching, you're looking at it for particular things, you're going to find more there, right? And that was surely the case with Cat People on a second viewing. So I came around even more on this one.
It's one that I'm going to be evangelizing heavily. And one of the great things about old horror movies, I love the new Criterion poster from Bill Sienkiewicz. I might actually be able to talk my wife into letting me get in that poster, because horror posters are not something that I probably get too many of just because of the grim imagery. But I was like, I bet I could get away with getting a Cat People poster.
That'd be nice.
So there's two that I kind of, just because of for the sake of time, I kind of thought that they paired very well together, both the religious horror and the monster movies, because I was surprised. I watched four, I think, classic horror movies. And I was surprised a little bit that every single one of them had explicit biblical references, biblical language, calls to God as the sovereign, or the person, God as the being who has ordered nature, and any subversion of God's will is the thing that brings the consequences, or the solution is to try to return to or use the power of God in some way. And I was just really struck by that.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, we're talking what, 30s and 40s here. That's reflective of the time, how, and Hollywood's understanding of American culture in particular. It was, Hollywood felt like they were speaking to a viewership that was, for the most part, going to church every
that's
Sunday.
That's like the right? Hail Caesar boardroom there.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So this was top of mind for them. Is, I don't think it's so much that the screenwriters here are preaching necessarily what they believed, as much as echoing what they thought viewers would be hearing and be comfortable with encountering these horror stories within that religious context. To me, that's why it was. You still see religious horror today, of course, but it's a different context now. It's this, you know, it's this more secular age. Just if we think about it in terms of church attendance, we're all familiar with those numbers that's just been plummeting in recent decades. Whereas when these classic horror films you're discussing were coming out, church attendance was, I don't know if it was rising, but it was definitely higher.
It was
than
the
it
norm.
Is now. Maybe the norm is a good way to put it. Yeah, they're speaking
your
to the
norm, right?
Your average
person who went, like, the average, like, whole families went to the movies to get, like, going to the movies was very different in the 30s and 40s than it is now. And everybody went together. And, I mean, obviously, you might not take your young kids to see Dracula or the Wolfman or Creature from the Black Lagoon, but, like, they were mass products for everyone.
Mass products. Yep. And so this was Hollywood's understanding of the mass audience then. This is the culture the mass audience lived in and wanted to hear being spoken to, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like those a lot. I wasn't sure. Like, I love all movies. I don't have any bias against old or foreign or any of that, but I was like, I wonder how I'm going to think. Because I think last year I had intended to watch all of the Universal Frankensteins, but I instead got waylaid because my library, the Hammer Frankenstein films came in first. So I just, I powered through a ton of Hammer last year. So this year I'm going to try to do more of the classics, but I was like, these are all really good.
They're so fun. And the production design cannot be beat in those. Some of those, you know, Dracula's
The creature from the Black Lagoon looked incredible.
The costume design in that case is unreal. I mean, computer generated imagery couldn't come anywhere near that costume
design. The suit looked amazing and he somehow breathed in it. And that was like 80 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. It's great.
Come on, guys. But also the studio system gave them probably funding and infrastructure that was maybe a little bit more conducive. But I was just very, very impressed with those.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun.
So on the other side, you talk about directly religious stuff. Ganja and Hess is one I'm very excited to catch up with. I haven't done that one. But a movie that has haunted you professionally and in your podcast career is The Exorcist. And just want to do a quick check-in and kind of see where is Josh Larson now on William Friedkin's The Exorcist?
I think I'm where I was maybe 2 or 3 years ago, which is the highest I've ever been on it, which is to say appreciative, but still have quibbles, which puts me on the outside looking in. This is generally, especially when you talk to people of faith, this is the horror film for them, which I get because it directly wrestles with questions of faith. It's very well crafted. And that the director who just passed away recently, William Friedkin, you know, has crafted a film of haunting images, the use of score, all the stuff we look for in a good horror movie is there. I've just always had a little bit of a hiccup between what I perceive as the end movie's actual interest in these religious ideas at play and its interest in, you know, just having some broader jump scares, gross scares, however you want to call it, with these exorcism scenes or these possession scenes, I should say, with young Linda Blair. I just always have this little bit of feeling that the movie gets more excited about that than it does about exploring the religious questions at the heart of it, which are, you know, faith alongside science questions. Mm-hmm. Very interesting stuff. That's where the movie's at its best. I guess I wish it was more about that, you know, than I find it to be. But all that to say, you know, every time I revisit it, I realize, okay, there's more going on in this area than I gave it credit for before. I just got to get still back. I got to get past those exploitative elements. Maybe one day I will, and I'll say it's a masterpiece like everybody else.
How many spooky seasons until it gets a 5-star from Josh Larson?
See, this is where the stars come in, right?
Final topic. I'm very, very excited to talk to you about one of them. But the next one I want to talk about, my personal favorite, I think, genre. Like I really do enjoy slashers. There's a lot of, I love the monster movies, the religious horror when it is done, even just honestly, substantively, rather than exploitively. I like that a lot. But probably my personal favorite horror, what kind of drew me in with the Night of the Living Dead, is the prophetic horror.
Okay.
The fear of the evil in society.
Yeah. And this is one that's really had a resurgence, I think, especially after Jordan Peele's Get Out. Now we've seen a lot of these films. Another way to think about this, a non, you know, religious way to think about this, would be that these are horror films that also function as social commentary, right? And when we talk about it in theological terms, that's when I say, well, it's a fear of societal evil. It's a fear of these movements, these institutions, these ideologies within society that are representative of evil. So you think of things like rampant consumerism, racism, and so many of the great horror films do tackle exactly some of these ideas. And the best ones, I think, do it, even though you know what's going on, they still do it cleverly and they don't let that overtake the horror. And so you mentioned in terms of zombies and George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, I think his Dawn of the Dead even does this more explicitly, but it still works really well when he set that zombie movie in a shopping mall. This was, I'm forgetting the date, but 80s, I believe.
78,
at this point, late 70s. Okay, 78. And, you know, shopping malls were like a central part of American culture. And so in order to comment on how he saw this and greed, particularly for America, as overtaking society, well, let's let some zombies loose in a mall. And you have a couple metaphors working here, right? You see these zombies. These are the Romero zombies. So they're moaning and shuffling about as they walk through these stores, obviously lampooning what Romero sees as Americans who have given themselves over, their entire identity over towards consuming products. And then you have the way the survivors are trying to defend themselves in this mall. It's the last bastion of society to them. It's the last thing that they can't let go of or let get overtaken by the zombies. So you have a great zombie movie that's also working on this other level of commenting on what Romero saw as a societal problem. And some Christians might define as a societal evil. I mean, greed is, you know, prophets had a few things to say about greed in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I thought that initial trilogy is interesting too. Have you seen Day of the Dead yet?
Yes. Yeah.
That is set in a missile silo where of a time where people were scared, military might was the thing that we looked to for protection kind of how that eviscerated that as well. Like, I love that type of storytelling. Cause like whole brand here is the substance, like the idea of genre as social commentary, where, like you said, it's not beating you over the head. All of those films are scary. The practical effects are impressive. Many of the soundtracks are all times. And that's another thing that has had a big resurgence with the vinyl renaissance going on, like horror soundtracks, those 60s, 70s, 80s horror soundtracks, they are selling like crazy. These are well-made, fun movies that if the viewer is so inclined, and as people of faith, we ought to be, not that we don't have amusements ever, but we can enjoy them as, oh, like this is a good piece of art, but also this is saying something, and that's worthwhile.
Yeah. Yeah. Those, all three of those Romero films we just talked about, they're taking down idols, right? While also being effective zombie movies. The idol of military strength, the idol of consumerism. And when I was on the show last time, we talked about how racism is addressed in the original Night of the Living Dead. So yeah, they're each taking out a different idol.
So I don't really have anything in particular. This was another film that I'm like, maybe we should do like a substantive cinema on this in the future. If we ever spin off substantive cinema as its own show under our banner, there's a lot of these that I want to get with. But I really loved I Walked with a Zombie.
That was a really
wonderful little scary tale of generational guilt. And I was just deeply unnerved. You called it out specifically in the book, and I read it after I watched it. Just that scene with the troubadour singing about how the sins of the father, like are passed on, like how generational sins affect and are just devastating.
Yeah. And this is, you know, this is set on a former plantation in a Caribbean island, but it's the same family or further generations of the family.
Highly
colonial.
Like the whole point is, the highly colonization, like the first and final image I think is of the statue that was on the slave ship that brought them all there and is just very powerful.
And now it's in the courtyard of this plantation as a decorative piece, right? A fountain, essentially. And the imagery here, so effective. Water flowing over that face of the statue, which looks like, you know, tears or better for a horror genre, blood even. And credit some of those images to Jacques Tourneur as the director, the same as the 1942 Cat People.
I'm going to be going through his filmography as well. So another film I want to talk about before we get to our last topic, you mentioned it a few times in the book, and it's one for me that's also kind of hard to slot, and that's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So when I was thinking about having you on for this, my wife is my sounding board for a lot of things, and she may or may not listen to the show, but I was like, hey, hon, like, what do you think? Wait, doing a substantive cinema on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, would that be a little bit too much? She's like, yeah, absolutely. I was like, okay, maybe down the line, if it's maybe. But it's one that for a long time just repulsed me.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of it. And I kind of slot it somewhere between slasher in prophetic. The last few years, it's one of my favorites, or I think best. Like I think very highly of it. It's a 5-star movie for me. Maybe one way to put it, perhaps, is a cinematic equivalent of like a prophetic lament about the state of our country. It came out during a lot of social unrest. Like I think that whole Vietnam and the fallout of that in American culture was a very interesting time for a lot of areas of culture, but particularly for movies and artists and people who fought over there or who had friends die over there, seemingly for nothing and to no good nationally or globally, coming back and just kind of raging with films like that. And it's just going like, what are we? like the undefined nature of that evil, and like what does like isolation and like unfounded pride, like what can that, like how can that warp somebody? And I think that while being very uncomfortable, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a very expert kind of exercise in that.
Yeah, I have read some of those interpretations of it as a response to the Vietnam War, which I think are very, very smart and fascinating. You, as you suggested, when you said isolation, I think that's what I tapped into in terms of the context for the book. And again, why I did put it with other slashers, this idea of loneliness. You have this, not only do you have these young people in the van who end up lost or, you know, in this isolated, desolate Texas landscape, but you have this bizarre cannibal family there who have been ostracized. They're alone. It doesn't really explain exactly how that leads them.
Zero explanation.
And that's it. That is it for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre for me. You tapped into this as well, why it's one of the most disturbing horror movies I've ever seen, is because it's just unfettered, inexplicable evil. And again, we could go back to where we started this conversation. Why would you watch that? Well, you don't have to. Not everyone has to. I'll repeat that. But if you are interested,
many of our listeners, I might warn against. But
warn against, possibly. It's a rough one. It's a rough one. But if you're interested in exploring some of these questions, I think it's a vital film. Again, this idea of loneliness, but also the larger societal implications that you were touching on, where, maybe prophetic horror is another area that Texas Chainsaw Massacre could fit.
Well, and especially watching it in a post 2020 world where so many things have happened in the last couple years, looking at just the violence and the violence stemming from, like you said, isolation, maybe national or regional pride, like all these things kind of wrapped up in the film. I just think it is so, it gets at such visceral truths that it's almost like you can put a lot into it because it's so efficient and brutal and just full speed ahead. Like there's not really exposition in the movie.
Right, right. There's a chaos element to it that, yeah, feels, not exactly similar to the last couple of years, but I think we've had a tinge of that these last few years. And the chaos element in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is somewhat evocative of that.
And the last thing I'll say is the generational passing on when things are unexamined, just one of the most disturbing, not even necessarily scary, but one of the most disturbing images is of the patriarch of the family, the grandpa, being the one who has clearly corrupted or has passed on, preached this message of violence and depravity, and them cheering him on when he's not even able to fully execute it himself. And I just go, man, like this feels so prescient, even though it's deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's apt.
Finally here, Ghost Stories, The Fear of Guilt. One of my movies that I looked at your list, I'd seen about just under half of them when you posted your Fear Not list. So I watched several of them. One of the ones that I was most interested in, I believe it's on your top 10 of all time list and rated higher than Halloween, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Heredity, is last few years, the found footagey laptop ghost film Unfriended.
Oh, Unfriended. So good. Oh,
really?
I love that
you
one.
Gave it 4.5 stars. And I was like, Josh Larson, this, I love seeing it. So I was like, all right, I fired it up and I was like, man, that was pretty good.
Better than pretty good.
Not quite a 4.5 from me, but I was like, thank you for making me check that out. Why might people want to check out Unfriended? Why did it rate so highly?
Yeah. So the concept here, and this is how it is with so many horror movies, a great idea, a nugget of an idea, and then how is it executed? So the concept here, and this is 2015, something like that. So
yeah, relatively recent.
Relatively recently, but in technology terms, dated. So that's this true, is yes. where a bunch of high school friends are video chatting with each other on their laptops. And we come to learn
Skyping
that
back when Skype was what we all did with each other.
There you go. Exactly. And so the entire movie is one girl's laptop screen. That's the only thing we see. And we come to learn that they are somehow involved with a friend who had committed suicide about a year earlier. There are passing references to this. And as this shared video call goes on, someone joins the call purporting to be that girl who had committed suicide. So it is a ghost story. It deals, I won't spoil it, in, as you said, the fear I explore there, the fear of our guilt. And what I loved about it outside of this theological implications is that formal element. Just having, and it falls in the found footage category in some ways, screen be all that we see. The filmmakers have to generate suspense by things like, when does a notification window pop up? That's a jump scare in this movie. How does having the main character whose laptop we're seeing, the way she types messages and who she's typing to them, generate suspense? How do we interpret when she backs up and backspaces and deletes something? Is that an indication of her guilt? What is it suggesting to us? All of these elements are employed so brilliantly, even when the faces of the other people on the call begin to pixelate because maybe the internet is, you know, getting shaky or something like that. We're all familiar with this phenomenon, but watching it in this context, it turns them into ghosts, these ghostly images a little bit. And I'm telling you, it reminds me of the Blair Witch Project, in which, you know, it seems very simple on the surface. Oh yeah, just pretend like you found this footage, right? So it doesn't have to be very professional. It can look junky because it's supposed to be. But in that movie and in Unfriended, every little detail is thought out and employed to have some sort of implication like that. That is, it's just genius. It is. It's not the kind of genius we're used to praising or giving that many stars to, but I'm sorry, that's the level the movie's working on.
No, I love it. Yeah, I mean, the societal themes of peer pressure and bullying and teen suicide and all these things with the real, like, they built suspense. Technically, I was very impressed. Like you said, the suspense when you see that she's got all the different private chats going on along with the video chat, and when just the little text dots are coming up and, what is this next message from this entity going to be? And like, is this real? Is this someone messing with them? Is this actually a ghost? Like, is this a real ghost story or is this like a metaphorical ghost story? Like I was very impressed. Another one of those where it might've gotten a little higher. It got a perfect 3.5 in a heart for me. I thought it was great. It might have gotten a 4 or 4.5. It was one of those movies that if it ended like 5 seconds sooner, I think they went for a little bit of cheap extra sauce on the end, but it was very effective and a wonderful movie.
All right. I'm going to give you a blessing of freedom to let the stars go, and don't worry. Don't worry about what makes a half star or not. It's my gift to you.
No, I was very pleasantly surprised with Unfriended. Cat People was my favorite, but I was like, good. I remember seeing the trailer for it and the poster for Unfriended when it came out. And I was like, I'm going to pass on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and we've gotten, you know, variation since, and the generating
suspense. I hear the sequel is good.
I've not seen the sequel to that one, but even generating suspense by text, like incoming text, that's a common trope already, right? By now. Sure. So some of that stuff. Yeah.
And but I'm 8 years ago, that was probably maybe a pioneer perhaps.
Yeah. It may not have been one of the first, but it was definitely fresher at that point for sure.
Absolutely. So, and I also really loved at the end of the book, you're like, well, because it was intended to be an overview, right? Even maybe for some college students or things like that.
Yeah, yeah, that's what the folks at Real Spirituality were thinking of it as. They wanted to be approachable, digestible, assignable for, you know, a semester's class, something like that.
Yeah, I like how you said, apologies if I didn't include your favorite movie in there, but you had 65 that you covered to some degree of depth, so.
Yeah, I feel good about that.
Yeah, I'll include the Letterboxd list with all of your filmography there in the show notes there. Well, Josh, finally, before I let you go, obviously we mentioned several here. They can be ones we've mentioned. They can be new ones, personal favorites. If you could recommend for Substance shoutouts one or two movies that you would like, maybe one for everybody and then one for people who are maybe a little bit more of the enthusiast side.
In terms of horror you're talking about?
I'll say yes for this, since that's where
okay.
We're appreciating horror this hour.
Okay, so one for everybody. Revisit Jaws, because everybody's seen Jaws, and think about it in horror terms. And I think that might move you a little closer to, you know, I consider that a creature feature, but it might just move you closer to the genre in general. And then a harder one. Boy, if you really want to be bewildered, you mentioned it, Ganja and Hess. This is a sort of vampire movie that came out during the blaxploitation era, deeply concerned with religious ideas. It kind of pits Black American Christianity alongside an imagined, made up for the movie, but in African religion, and asks what belief means in both contexts, all within the context of a vampire movie. It's really weird. It took a second viewing for me to even begin to get my head around it, but it's one that I'm guessing maybe a lot of listeners have not even heard of. So if you really want to dive in deep, check out Ganja and Hess.
Excellent. Well, Josh, thank you for your time today. We'll have links in the show notes to buy your book. Where can people find you?
Oh man, you mentioned what social media is like these days. I'm just about everywhere except TikTok. So using the handle Larsen on Film, LARSEN on Film, if you wanna look for me at your social media platform of choice. Otherwise, I'm doing work every day over at thinkchristian.net and then the weekly Film Spotting podcast as well.
Excellent. I have links in the show notes there. Everybody follow Josh. I really appreciate all the various things that you make for us and for the culture, the world, and the church. And thank you for your time here.
Thanks, Philip. I appreciate that. Thanks for having me back on the show.
There you go. I told you it was a great conversation. And if you don't believe me now, maybe go back and listen. You weren't listening closely enough. But so glad that Josh Larsen was able to join us. Make sure you check out his new book and grab a copy for yourself. Fear Not, A Christian Appreciation for Horror. And if you enjoyed this conversation and you can think of someone who might, maybe they already do love horror and they would get something out of this, or you know someone who's a little sketched out about horror movies, but this might be thought-provoking for them, think of someone who might benefit from listening to this episode and share it with them. Word of mouth recommendations always go a really long way. Another way to help the show is to give us a 5-star rating and review wherever it is that you listen to podcasts. And then, of course, you can financially support the show as well by going to patreon.com/thesubstancepod. Sign up for one of those tiers, $3, $6, $10, or $20. Right now, the benefit for all of our patrons, regardless of tier, is that you will help us decide some of the future books and movies that we will cover here on The Substance Pod. Will give you first pick. We'll put out a couple different books, a couple different movies. You'll vote on them, and then those will be the ones that you hear covered on The Substance. So if you want to be a part of helping direct this show, then you can head over to Patreon. And another perk that I talked to Philip about, I've been writing over at hallahan.substack.com, and you can go be a free subscriber over there. Along with the writing, I'm doing a podcast episode once a month, but I'm recording them well in advance. And so I'm actually going to release them early for patrons of the Substance Pod. And so actually within the next week or so, you'll be able to hear me, Editor Dave, talk with Andrew Whitehead, who is a professor of sociology at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, co-author with Samuel Perry of Taking America Back for God, but author of his most recent book, American Idolatry: How Christian Nationalism Betrays the Gospel and Threatens the Church. And so we discuss that book. And so if you want to hear that conversation before anybody else is able to, and other conversations like it, I have one scheduled with Joash Thomas, who is the Director of Mobilization for International Justice Mission Canada. We're going to be talking, so you'll hear that probably some point in October. And I've got a few other ones coming down the pipe. So if you want to hear those types of conversations and help direct the Substance Pod, and this is a podcast that has benefited you, then we ask you to consider becoming a patron. Again, that's patreon.com/thesubstancepod. Well, thank you so much for tuning in, for sharing, for giving us a rating and review, for letting a friend know about this, and for considering that Patreon. We'll see you in 2 weeks. On the next episode of The Substance, but just know that the October Substantive Cinema episode just may be one that you heard Josh and Philip mention during their conversation. So let us know on social media which one you think it will be, and we'll see you next time on The Substance.